Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder. This is the Learning College. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also at alexlinder.com, permanently archived. Today we're going to pick up James Mason's Siege at Chapter 7. We're going to do 7.1 through 7.5. He has an unusually long segment there, and we'll find out what it's all about. Anyway, Chapter 7 is called Strength and Spirit. And again, these segments in this book were compiled from his newsletters that he published in 1980 to 1986. He was with the National Socialist Liberation Front, but he kind of became a one-man show as he got tired of the mass strategy and working with other groups. But clearly the dominant person he met in the movement was Commander Lincoln, George Lincoln Rockwell, who was assassinated. But he refers to Rockwell and the lessons he learned from Rockwell quite a bit. So we'll pick it up on page 312 with 7.1. Turning to the text, we find Chapter 7, Strength and Spirit. First, some epigraphs, three of them, from Nietzsche, and Mikhail Bakunin, a famous anarchist, perhaps even the founder of anarchism. I'm not entirely sure, at least the first in history associated with its name in Russia in the 1800s, I think. But first, Nietzsche. Strength is the morality of the man who stands out from the rest, and it is mine. And again, Nietzsche, such men alone are my readers, my proper readers, my preordained readers. Of what account are the rest? The rest are simply ... humanity. One must be superior to humanity in power, in loftiness of soul, in contempt. Friedrich Nietzsche. And finally, Mikhail Bakunin, Russian anarchist, not a Jew, actually. He said, the idea of God implies the abdication of human reason and justice. It is the most decisive negation of human liberty and necessary ends in the and necessarily ends in the enslavement of mankind, both in theory and in practice. He who desires to worship God must harbor no childish illusions about the matter, but bravely renounce his liberty and humanity. Again, Mikhail Bakunin, B-A-K-U-N-I-N. 7.1, the antisocial streak versus the decadent society. The Jews in the liberal system love portraying us as antisocial misfits. Sometimes when we get down on each other, just like Jews versus Jews or Negroes versus Negroes calling one another kike or motherfucker, we tend to steer away from the term misfit and go rather to professional loser or something like that. So between the two, I think a certain principle can be found that could be of greater value if we are to develop into something. First, we should be aware that in a sick or even mildly mediocre society such as exists today, early mid-80s, it is a badge of honor to be possessed of an antisocial streak. It will keep you safe and high above the trash and poison of the milieu, right from birth, where no amount of, quote, proper education, good background, upbringing, etc. could. How many from the so-called best families are completely degenerate zombies? Myself, I was always classed not only as the black sheep of the family, but also as habitually hanging with the wrong crowd. And he had he went to reform school, and he had run-ins with the public school teachers. He was almost an early Columbine type, in fact. So for me, at least, joining the Nazi Party at age 14 just sort of made it all official. A skillful hypocrite, i.e. good citizen in a sick society, one that really knows how to assimilate or conform and generally doesn't rock the boat, is a disgusting system suck. I can have more respect, if that's the right word, for the rabid liberal or red than I can for the system sucks and the establishment creeps. SS and EC capitalized. In any event, to go from one to the other is a national pastime and involves nothing more than a change of clothes, an expensive slick new hairstyle, and that certain mercenary acquisitive drive. But a good solid antisocial streak, born right in the blood, cannot be changed by anything. Physical suffering, brainwashing, disillusionment, discouragement, defeat, absolutely nothing. It's been rightfully referred to as the common denominator of all true believers, that is, of all fanatics. An antisocial streak is what all true believers have in common. Interesting. I don't think Eric Hoffman would have seen it that way. It must, therefore, also be the key ingredient for all the revolutionaries. Being white isn't enough. Being educated isn't enough. Being idealistic isn't enough. Dedication, determination, and so forth, all can be undone by circumstances. One has got to be a part, and he capitalizes a part. Currently, most of the best revolutionaries in the United States are non-white. That's because they are taught to view this society as something to which they do not belong, but something to which they must break into, overcome, and conquer. It is therefore more easy for them to become revolutionary than it is for most whites who are instilled with the defeatist complex right from birth. Unlike the Untermenschen of the world, with maps of Israel or the jungle written across their faces, we find our alienation in the special knowledge that this is not our society in any way, shape, or form. We find ourselves by far greater outsiders here than any non-national Jew, black, Asian, or what have you. There is no way we can assimilate or work within the system. Further, there is no way we can be bought off, the way Huey Newton, a black radical, Jerry Rubin, a Jew radical, or Abby Hoffman, another Jew radical, and the like, were bought off. The 60s radicals were bought off. With them, it was just a different side of one world. With us, it's an entirely different planet. We can't quit, nor can we be thinned out or watered down. Our very guts are on fire. We are the real revolutionaries. As long as the movement remains part of the defense of something that it does not belong with, then it will continue to share in the unremitting defeat of the past 60 years. When a substantial segment of the movement realizes that it is we who are the strangers who must come, see, and conquer, only then will we begin to exert a measure of the earth-shaking power potential that we have. So let us draw a fine distinction between someone who is antisocial, a misfit, or a malcontent, for what kind of a crawling dog would be content in this society, and the archetypal professional loser, in quotes, for there is no natural connection between the two. I can think of nothing more formidable than a band of malcontents who know exactly where they are, who they are, what they want, and how to go about getting it. The job is to build a world of our own, not to pull someone else's chestnuts out of the fire. Not a defense, but an attack. To borrow a revolutionary press statement by Ed Reynolds, we don't want to rock the boat, we want to sink it. That was Volume 9, Number 6, October 1980. Now that's funny. 7.2 is the true believer. The Hoffman I just referenced comes up in this very next segment, which is funny. This is the title of a well-known book that is generally frowned upon by idealistic movement people as hailing the antithesis of what we're supposed to be all about and what motivates us. I disagree, says Mason. The thrust of this work by Eric Hoffer, that's right, I said Hoffman, but it's Hoffer, has it that all people of a fanatic bent, regardless of persuasion, have in common the fact that they are deficient in one or more fundamental human areas. Well, that's not precisely what he said. What he said was faith in a cause is a substitute for lost faith in oneself. And that's more common to the left than the right, I would argue. He means like people who believe in communism. These then seek to compensate or overcompensate for this, their personal deficits in various areas, by joining fanatic causes as they see their mortal earthly existence as ruined or worthless. I think Hoffer is very close to correct, says Mason. The True Believer is the book. It's a thin, it's a good book, worth reading. Eric Hoffer was the longshoreman philosopher, he was called. Back in those days, remember, before World War II, it wasn't like now when 50% or more of traditionally college-age people went to college. College metastasized after the war ended, World War II, and the GIs came back. Before then, it was more or less the top 10% who went to college, or only 10% of that age group went to college, and not the top 10%. That meant that there were a lot of educated working class people who never had a chance to go to college. Eric Hoffer would have been one of them. That's why he was the longshoreman philosopher, because that was his job, a longshoreman, I think, in San Francisco. Yet he was a genuine intellectual at the same time. You would not find that kind of person today, almost very rarely. Or if you found them, it would have been after they'd already been through the system. Now, Mason says, do we as National Socialists not agree that the individual self is not the end-all, but that it is the race itself which is of supreme importance? And even if one were, as are so many millions today, so self-centered, can it be denied that this materialistic society has rendered the business of going about life a pretty tired, miserable affair? Intolerable, in fact, without some higher purpose? So what would it take to force a person out of the mold, out of the rut, and into an entirely new and different framework? It would seem that it would have to be something profound, deep within, something that a person cannot escape from, a fire that cannot be extinguished. Good or bad, anything, just so he is separated from the mainstream of the system and the establishment. From there, it has a great deal to do with the person, what stuff he is made of, and to a far lesser degree, the breaks he does or doesn't receive. To assume that people in general can be shown the light and be expected to drop the rest and go with it is to exhibit a naivete in assessing human nature which approaches the ludicrous. It is toward that kind of humanity that Nietzsche and Hitler strove, but, as we each know, those plans have been seriously set back. No, it remains biological, but at the same time it remains immutable, if we can only understand its workings, come to grasp it, and be able to use it toward our own ends. That is a subject matter which we have discussed previously in Siege. My point here is that each of us must first recognize and then decide which type he chooses to be, and then really go at it with a vengeance, so as to make his mark a significant one. To, quote, not fit into this society can be a distinct badge of honor. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. To not make it in a money-based society, oppressed, exploited, and persecuted by money men and by money considerations, and to be scorned and ridiculed by a conventional world, does not mean that one is a loser in the true sense necessarily. Is one to struggle in order to exist at the bottom rung of an alien society in failure and abject misery? Or should one rebel completely and stand forth as a different and possibly superior kind of being? Not as a leftover from the dead past, but rather as a point man securing a path for the coming of the wave of the future. Nobody ever said this would be easy, and obscure poverty-stricken endings are very large possibilities. But again, it is to choose which type is superior and, thereby, more desirous. An historic breed which changes faces and reappears according to the changing of the eras? Or that kind of person who would be only what he is, part of the scenery, in any era? An historic breed or an ever-present type? Those who make history or those who make the background? Our type, the true believer, will one day rule again. The rest, under whatever society, will go on being serfs. Take your pick. Volume 11, Number 12, December 1982. 7.3 Alienation. A large segment of the racialist movement in this country is devoted to identity. Capital I, a branch of Christian religion which claims that the white races are the true Israelites. None may be found which devotes itself to or refers to itself as alienation. Yet in the present-day society, there is a lot more to be alienated by or from than there is to identify with. In the pages of Siege, we try to concern ourselves with that which, quote, makes things go round, instead of engaging in wishful thinking. It is not negativism if we can gain understanding of the forces which exist and which tend to work in our favor so that we might better put them to use. Before anyone can hope to understand or appreciate revolutionary or outlaw mentality and morality, they must first know alienation. It is impossible to sympathize fully with this kind of philosophy unless one shares a healthy appreciation of alienation, and it is just as impossible to become a revolutionary oneself unless one is himself alienated. I'm not talking about born losers, common weirdos, or run-of-the-mill antisocial types. I'm not talking about those who wouldn't make it in any society due to personal deficiencies. I am speaking of people who do not fit into this society because of what it is and what they are. To be outside this society is a marked badge of honor. I'm speaking of people who didn't have the luxury of making a choice, people who aren't in this for fun. Members of the establishment, though some may think it in our direction, only seek a way out. They yearn for a return to the days of brisk business and high profits, i.e. business as usual. To them, revolution is a dirty word because it carries a distinct connotation of being bad for profits. They are said to believe if everyone would just go out and get a steady job, all would be well. They hardly even want to rock the boat, only unload or perhaps rearrange some ballast. They appear to take us as one more form of hard right winger, albeit the kind which they must be careful to hide any connection with, for profit's sake. They really do not comprehend that we are at war with this society, and that it is them or us. We, as part of our revolutionary program, intend to blast to hell their filthy, scum-tainted system of profit values. Were they to become fully aware of this, it is likely that our fringe supporters would begin to leave us. So much is said about alienation that perhaps it might be wise to add a prefix, super-alienation, to the term to bring out its meaning. This super-alienation marks the actual difference between a mere asocial and a genuine political radical. The asocial considers to hell with it. The politically oriented radical is determined to get in his licks. The asocial is only separated, hanging in space, while the radical is girded and made unflappable in the face of a hostile world. Most significantly, the radical has found his own set of rules to go by. As often as not, he makes up the rules as he goes along. No superstitions exist to him, such as the abstracts of good and evil. There is only that which works, and that which does not. Those behavioral aberrations that so dismay members of the establishment really are not bad, per se, in themselves. To get the job done, it calls for whatever traffic will allow. If anything, the situation calls for a greater number of increasingly alienated, radicalized people. Only occasionally so far in Siege have I invoked the name of Charles Manson. Those who have begun to understand the thrust of the overall philosophy may be beginning to see how Manson fits into the scheme of things. Aside from that, it can be said that the name of Manson evokes the same kind of instantaneous division of thought inside the movement that the name of Hitler does outside the movement. It was once said of Hitler and the swastika that they represented the, quote, threshold of anger. At the very mention, most will curse you, a few will join you, none will remain neutral. I have found the same is true of Manson and the swastika, even within the Nazi movement. Manson is the threshold of alienation. Some in the movement have begun by calling me insane, along with Manson, of course, and have gone on to become members themselves in record short time. Others, for the sake of friendship and unity, have opted to bypass the issue with some embarrassment. Some Nazi sympathizers actually denounce Manson as a freak and a murderer. What company do we keep these days? We have plenty of conservative reactionaries who freely don the swastika and sing the praises of Hitler, but we have no conservative reactionaries who accept Manson. A pissed-off conservative might exclaim in mixed company how we need, quote, another Hitler to straighten out the mess, but how many come right out and state their belief in doing away with the mess entirely? How many in the movement actually relish it every time the establishment and its economic value system takes another direct kick in the teeth? How many are out to sink the boat, not merely rock it? Manson represents the great divide between those persons who imagine there are still choices to be made, casually, on the basis of establishment mores, and those who have a profound individual sense of, quote, no going back. I believe it is this, and not the abstract idea of realism, that is the great sustainer and inner flame of all true revolutionaries. The sense of no going back, profound individual sense of no going back, that is the great sustainer and inner flame of all true revolutionaries. 100% commitment. Quote, "These are not my people," views the alienated radical. Life and the struggle are greatly simplified in that manner. That was Volume 11, Number 6, June 1982. 7.4, Background to Siege. Perhaps what it all boils down to is outlining two ways, the easy and the hard, of getting the stars out of one's eyes, for, until that is done, by whatever means, that person is going to be a victim to all the pitfalls and hostile forces which surround him. And to clear the record, I do not advocate intellectualizing ourselves or our struggle. Our enemies are intellectualized, computerized, mechanized, dehumanized. And for that reason, they wouldn't fight for a damn thing. As Manson would say, we are pro-life, anti-death. We still have the spark and the feel of life within us, and that is why we fight. I simply say that we pick up the fight in earnest, approximately at this moment in time, despite any and all exhaustive effort gone before. But at least we're pretty much sobered up. We'll need to be. Cold rationality can only carry you so far. Then it leaves you stranded in the middle of a field. In talking with people, I may use terms like spiritual, but more precisely, I mean gut instinct, as dictated by millions of years of genetic development. This is as close to a literal translation of being in direct communication with one's distant ancestors as we'll probably ever get, listening to our gut instincts about what's going on in the biggest sense. At the same time, being in abidance with one's true gods would also come under this heading. Noble thoughts and ideals, irrational as hell. But this provides us with our biggest advantage over our enemies, our legitimate reason for existing as individuals, our purpose in life, something bigger than ourselves and certainly as big as the universe itself. That is an experience these liberal types can never know and can never understand. Alone, it sustains us. Combined with the weaponry of cold thought process, it will lead us to victory over all odds. It is here where political activity should properly enter the picture. Politics, if it is serious, is the coldest of human endeavors. Colder still than war, because war is only an extension of politics. And you know who said that. Commander Rockwell called true politics the highest art because it embodies all the other art forms. Accepting this as the case, as anyone who has studied art will know, it demands the highest degree of discipline and training in order to bring the artist's own natural instincts and abilities to full flower. My own idea and understanding of the word politics means this for its own ends. This is where the confusion must be eliminated. Once the ideals are established and the decision to fight is made, then the rules of going about gaining power to put them into practice can be summed up by saying, play the ball as it lies. Deal with things as they are, where they are, not where you want them to be or think they should be. There is no room for sentimentality of any kind in the practice of politics. And I emphasize again that, in terms of the present, politics and revolution are practically synonymous. That it's the sentiment that counts is garbage. The bullet put in the head of your opponent by you, or vice versa, gets there precisely the same way and means exactly the same thing to either. That is phase one politics. Phase two politics may get around to it, just why you put that bullet in there in the first place, but by that point, the questions are all over anyway. Volume 12, number 7, July 1983, that was. And now we have 7.5, and this is the exceptionally long one, why we're doing 5 of these instead of the usual 10 or 11. So the length overall will be about the same. 7.5, God can stay, but the church must go. I'll never be part of a war on something that is unseeable and unknowable. So this is not a war on God. George Lincoln Rockwell wrote often that the positions of the religious fanatics and of the fanatical atheists were equally ridiculous and impossible. For no human being can know whether there is a supreme being, and no human can know whether there is not. All I say is that no supportive evidence exists to indicate there might be. But that's why no argument can really be had on the matter. There exists nothing upon which to base an intelligent, reasonable argument. That is not the point of the following segments of Siege. We are playing no favorites. Jew, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Shinto, etc. These huge and powerful, wealthy and influential institutions, based on man's greatest fears and weaknesses, created upon pure superstition, which have wrought so much damage, destruction, confusion, and unwisdom, and are getting worse and worse each year, have got to be viewed by all true revolutionaries as among the primary tentacles in the body of Big Brother. Organized religion, when speaking in terms of the white race, is a terrible and deadly enemy. We'll examine some of the reasons why later on, but I am prompted now to print this piece, which has been in preparation for many months, because of such things as the moral majority craze that Jerry Falwell in the early 80s, when he's writing this, and similar such movements afoot in the conservative backlash camp, the new right it was called back then. There's been a million of them, but Richard Viguerie and moral majority. Direct mailing was the big thing, technically, where they were able to gin up list of conservatives. We cannot and must not fall victim to this, their hogwash, ourselves, of this new right in the moral majority. Subtitle, Opiate of the Masses. So this is much longer than one of his normal segments, so it actually has subtitles and is more of a prepared piece. Now he says, there can hardly be any question that the church has been edged out, or at least relegated to a backseat position, for the title of Opiate of the Masses, that was the communist phrase, Marxist phrase, which organized religion held for many centuries. The new one, of course, is television. After all, you don't have to go to it on Sunday. The foul thing lives in your home with you. For entertainment purposes, it is practically any preacher going beat by a mile, though look at how many of them use television. Everything the church used to offer the community, the television now offers. From sermons, editorials, and more subtle propaganda, to fellowships, imaginary, of course, in the form of soap operas, to even passing the plate, commercials, plus everything in between. The nominally white actors on television are co-equal with the nominally white ministers in church. Both read straight from Jewish scripts. Not attacking inanimate objects, neither buildings nor boxes, churches or TV sets, but only the way they are handled and the effects they are having on the white race, there is little doubt that television is the worst of the two. But the television is not an institution and can be very helpful, beneficial in fact, once all the networks are in National Socialist hands. What of the church after a National Socialist revolution? Shall we put armbands on all priests? Or shall we put stormtroopers in black robes? Shall we attempt to enlighten those now in power and pray that they will behave themselves and not act the role of subversives in our midst? Can we afford to allow an incredibly large and powerful organization, a state within a state, that currently is a major part of the enemy's scheme, to go on functioning as before once our revolution has succeeded? More importantly, as we must decide now, is it at all necessary that we do so? The answer in each case is no. At present, the church presents its worst danger to the white race because of the common denominator of all messages parroted by the born-agains. Lay down, submit, and let God handle it. It has all been written. It is all inevitable. Further, it is only the next world that matters. This world and this life mean nothing. So just concentrate on avoiding sin, or go ahead and sin, but beg like crazy for forgiveness, and really score points for the hereafter. Hang it all up in the present reality of today, here and now, and bank everything on some afterlife in some never-never land. If that doesn't sound like some kind of opiate, then I don't know what one is. New subtitle, Can You Do Voodoo? The monumental cathedrals built by the genius of Western man in the name of his religion compare identically to the mud and clay huts and carved wooden idols that the primitive races erect to their peculiar religions. Same comparison as our ICBM missiles to their spears and blowguns. Same concepts of war and religious worship, just that the white man does it better. One big stumbling block on our way toward Nietzsche's concept of the Superman is what we still share with the lower and lowest specimens of humanity. Guilt, fear, conscience, hang-ups of every sort, psychological self-limitations, idiotic notions of good and evil, unreason and plain superstition. If we can't break with subhumanity on the psychological level, then we can hardly hope to part company with them on the physiological level. If you're going to think like a primitive savage, then you might as well be a primitive savage. What makes Christianity seem to be the religion for mankind has nothing whatsoever to do with any of its promises or tenets, for the Muslim faith promises sex in the hereafter, not even with how many people in the world today embrace its philosophy, which, incidentally, is a minority. It is because that was the religion that so happened to get foisted off onto the white man, and it was his genius and creativity that gave it its strength, beauty, charity, forcefulness, and whatever real value it may once have possessed. Anything of a positive nature to be found in the doctrine or workings of Christianity did not come from the sky or from the pages of a book, but rather from the blood of the white race which foolishly adopted it. Blacks, browns, and yellows aren't backward or savage because of any backward or savage religion. It is because it is their nature to be so. The lowest level primitive in the jungles of Haiti is no more voodooistic than the highest bishop or cardinal in Europe or America. But the style and presentation are a hell of a lot different. Dog and cat heaven. Not only does man fear death so much that he elevates himself up and out of the animal realm, but it appears to be a human trait, an urge, to imbue everything from house pets to stuffed dolls with identities and souls. Could heaven be complete minus the family dog or cat? I agree that an animal can be every bit as much a family member as a human being, but at the same time it must be seen that we share the same mortality. By the time of the 19th century, there were armies of screw-loose soul jockeys, quote-unquote, swarming into those areas of Asia and Africa which were colonized or conquered by the West. These missionaries were doing their best to score points in the afterlife by making human beings out of jungle savages through laying a little religion on them, sprinkling a little water on them, and repeating a few gobble gobbles over them. The ridiculous notion of a super repressed, super uptight Christian missionaries trying to teach the lowest savages how to copulate properly gave rise to the well-known missionary position. More than one of these lame brains ended up in a stew pot. No loss there. The worst of this was seen at the time of the U.S. Civil War. Tokens were circulating at the time, depicting blacks on their knees in chains under slogans like, "Am I not a man and a brother?" The object was to make you look immoral if you retorted, "Hell no!" Mad dog Christian fanatics were busy setting the stage for the worst bloodbath the country had yet experienced. World War I and World War II inclusive. More were killed in those than in the world wars in the 20th century. The Civil War claimed more white American lives than any other. From Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin to John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, the issue was a religious one on the part of all the forces driving toward war, and not one of property, politics, or even the Constitution. Plain old-fashioned religiosity. Fanatical egalitarians were responsible. I should say, plain old-fashioned religiously fanatical egalitarians were responsible. The legend, "In God We Trust," first made its appearance on U.S. coinage at the time of the Civil War. This opened the way for the first marriages between blacks, who had previously been paired off and mated like any other animal, and marriages between blacks and whites, because after all, if two people love each other, love in quotes, and are good Christians, then what the hell? The purest, most healthy, and beautiful white child would be condemned as a, quote, bastard by these same mad dog Christians, while a real racial bastard product of mixed parentage would be blessed by them, depending solely on whether or not they had their marriage vows solemnized in the prescribed Christian manner. Today it is still found that some ministers will refuse to marry two people if it is found that both have been divorced. But a racially mixed pair, neither previously married, will be immediately joined in holy matrimony. This is as bad, if not worse, than the criminal tampering and twisting that's done with the U.S. Constitution, making anything and everything that so happens to have been whelped on this piece of real estate an automatic, quote, citizen, therefore, quote, equal to all the rest and wide open to all the civil rights invented or created in his behalf. But to do away completely with the reality and the ultimate importance of race, in preference to some magical, mystical harem scarum, is no more than insanity. And when applied in an organized, enforced manner, it becomes criminal insanity and must be stopped. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. In two world wars, German soldiers went into battle bearing as part of their uniform this motto, Gott mit uns, God is with us. A lot of good it did them. In every war between white men of different European countries, the leaders and combatants of both sides prayed to the same God from the same Bible for blessings and victory. White men have been killing each other for 2,000 years in the name of the same religion. And if nationalistic frictions weren't present, then a religious, quote, reformation, etc., took place to get the bloodbath started up again. For what? So that God's will may be done on earth as it is in heaven. A hell of a lot of responsibility in the hands of those who interpret just whatever God's will might be at the moment. For hundreds of years, the church has been an extension of the state. In the beginning, it was the other way around, but the manipulators have been perfecting their methods. Today, the church is indispensable to Big Brother. When the church isn't acting as the echo chamber of the Big Brother system, then it is acting as its avant-garde. Turnabout is fair play, and it also keeps the goyish masses confused. The leaders of the church hold the same ranking in the establishment as the leaders of government, the military, the professions, arts, business and industry, etc. And they all went corrupt, sold out, at the same time, at the same rate. They all spout the same line, for the same reason, and prompted by the same people. That which the tastemakers slash opinion formers decide upon and declare, their servants then take this and poison the masses with it as current, established, accepted, quote-unquote, gospel, which to rebel against or even question means personal ruin, if not eternal damnation. Separation of church and state in reality merely means separate accounts in the same Jew-owned bank. Special dispensation is the next subtitle, question mark. In 1969 and 1970, we witnessed it firsthand in this small community what was being repeated all over the country involving church leadership. I should emphasize that I am referring throughout primarily to the major branches of organized religion, the big ones, the wealthy ones, the ones that are literally part of the establishment. In this particular case, there was a Presbyterian minister who represented the leadership in this town of the treason movement during the Vietnam era. I had just gotten back home from the November treason, quote, moratorium in Washington, where National Socialists had been the only opposition and attackers against hundreds of thousands of vile liberal, communist, and religious swine who were staging a Dolchstoß, or backstab, a thousand times more disgusting than that experienced by Germany in 1918, when I learned that similar demonstrations, on a smaller scale, had been staged here in Chillicothe, Ohio. Another one was set for December, and our local people knew without discussion what had to be done. I had been informed that during those first demonstrations, a Viet Cong flag had been flown. Besides being there, our first objective was to see to it that if any enemy flags were flown, they would end up as war trophies and their bearers as war casualties. It was Christmas Eve. The weather was cold and the snow was getting deep, but we waited in front of the courthouse for the treason march to arrive at the end of its route from the Presbyterian Church on the hill. We heard them before we saw them, chanting in the true Red style, "Peace now, peace now," each one carrying a candle and numbering at least 50, and headed by a black-garbed minister. Six of us against 50 of them was much, much better odds than we had at the Washington Monument a month before, when it had been about 50 of us against 150,000 of them. I briefed our guys quickly as the column approached that if anyone hoisted a VC flag, the fight was on, and that unlucky bastard was the principal target. The secondary target was the obvious patron saint, in quotes, of the demonstration, the minister. No special dispensation for that dirty bastard either. While tensions mounted, teeth chattered, and ugly hissed comments were exchanged between former friends and classmates of the opposing sides, the cops slowly prowled the area, expecting trouble. No commie banner was displayed on this, the first occasion where they were met by opposition. It broke up without incident, and there were no more such demonstrations here. But the following year it was reported that the same minister's wife had been raped in her home by a black. Later it came out that the black was a frequent visitor to their home in the bourgeois west end of town. Then it came out that they were every bit as involved with civil rights as they were with treason. Some surprise. Finally, it wasn't a rape case at all. Maybe just a case of someone forgetting to say please and thank you. The report had come weeks after the alleged incident. We did some digging and found an open cesspool in the midst of which was the minister and his wife. In the end, they soon pulled up and left town. A little effort in the right direction before the cancer takes hold can work wonders. Nationally, however, it is too late. The most radical surgery is called for, and still the patient might well die. How about the dead nuns in El Salvador? An identical case. No special dispensation was granted there either, and damn good riddance, so the right-wing government and its death squads killed left-wing nuns working with the communist rebels. But look at the hue and cry raised by Big Brother media all over the world. So what if Catholic nuns aid the spread of communism? That's liberation theology. El Salvador was a, you who are young might not realize, but El Salvador and Nicaragua were huge deals in the 1980s, and then after that, never heard of again. Never heard from again after the Reagan years. You're not supposed to touch. I say bullshit. Part of what eventually destroyed Hitler in Germany was the rampant treason going on inside the Reich by elements of the old order, which Hitler permitted to survive after 1933. Unlike Stalin's policies in the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s. But Hitler's revolution was peaceful and legal, and so therefore, I suppose, that's what happens. It's not going to be like that here. It's not going to be peaceful or legal, and the National Socialist Revolution here will pull no punches. They won't allow the Jews to escape like Hitler did, and they won't allow treasonous elements of the old order to survive, he's saying. The entire establishment, capital letters, is guilty of wholesale treason. The church included, as far as I'm concerned. It will be a situation of up against the wall, motherfucker. Integral part of the problem. Ever notice the similarity between the tenets of Christianity and those of Marxism? They both negate race and private property. They indulge in brainwash, treason, subversion, and have resorted to torture and war to get where they want to go. Supposedly a movement for the poor, the hierarchy of both is filthy rich. The Pope and the International have a lot in common with regard to questionable national loyalties, and I wonder how the church would fare against a House Un-American Activities Committee-style investigation. HUAC, Joe McCarthy. The bulk of the communist world is non-white, as is the majority of those professing the Christian religion. The liberals and Marxists would both have you mix with Negroes on earth, while the Christians would have you mixed with them for the rest of eternity. That would be my own idea of hell. What follows is a quote from Mikhail Bakunin, a Russian nobleman, anarchist, and atheist in the 19th century. Bakunin was not a Jew, nor was he a Marxist in any form. He saw what had taken place in his country and arrived at certain inescapable conclusions. He said, quote, "The idea of God implies the abdication of human reason and justice. It is the most decisive negation of human liberty and necessarily ends in the enslavement of mankind, both in theory and in practice. He who desires to worship God must harbor no childish illusions about the matter, but bravely renounce his liberty and humanity." Says Mason, "These are essentially the same conclusions we must realize here in the United States today, that the entire establishment has long since been subverted from within by aliens, by traitors, and by the corrupt opportunists. The entire structure of this society, all of its institutions, etc., have been turned into meaningless, rotten, and actually dangerous and destructive to the interests of our people. The plain fact is that the church is a part of this, a very large part. Most of our readers already are well aware of the conditions prevailing in Germany under the foul Weimar regime, with the alien domination and the resultant decadence during the 1920s. Very few realize what the conditions were in Russia from about the turn of the century to the time of the revolution. They were the same. The Tsar's problem was that he was an early forerunner of Jimmy Carter. Not a tyrant, but a liberal suckhole who betrayed his people and his empire. The whole ruling class of Russia at the time was with him in this betrayal. A war was lost to Japan in 1905 that was funded by Jew Jacob Schiff, who later funded the Communist Revolution, and that was the first time a white war was lost to a colored, I believe. And another lost to Germany in 1917. The Treaty of Brest-Litovsk established peace between Germany and Russia, World War I, through corruption and ineptitude. Look at the U.S. experience in Vietnam and Iran. Russian roulette was coined at the time as a pastime for the totally burnt-out, idle rich. Look at our drugs and suicides. Outright varlets like Rasputin were mingling and fraternizing sexually with the court at St. Petersburg. Check the pictures of John Wayne Gacy and Jim Jones posing with Rosalind Carter, President Carter's wife. And there is a very funny picture of her with John Wayne Gacy, the homosexual killer of dozens of young boys in the Chicago area. And all the while, Russia was a land of churches, more and bigger all the time. Yet events continued on an ever-increasing downhill grade for that country until the system finally went bust, along with the land and the people. Today, the United States is the most, quote, church-going country on earth. No one, not even the arch-fakers like Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell, would attempt to deny that the U.S. is also the modern-day Sodom and Gomorrah. Con artists and Big Brother fellow travelers preaching a, quote, return to God and, quote, moral majority are becoming millionaires, while this country sinks ever deeper into a nightmarish, real-life, earthbound hell. The more churches and the more religion, the more corruption and the more decadence. These types are a major part of the problem and will go out right along with the rest of the facets of the overall blight affecting this world. What a racket they've enjoyed. Promise them pie in the sky and proceed to rob them of the only riches and the only life they'll ever have. And it's been going on for centuries. Man created God in his own image. Had it been the other way around, then fakers like Billy Graham couldn't today state that perhaps God is black, and perhaps Jesus was an Ethiopian. They say that the universal belief in a God of some sort and in a hereafter is proof, quote-unquote, that these things are valid and real. It is proof only of man's all-consuming fear of death and his unwillingness to accept his own morality, or mortality, and his subjectivity to the laws of nature, just like any other animal. It should have been subjection to the laws of nature, not subjectivity. You mean something else. Marxism and Christianity are both religions and philosophies with long lists of rules, tenets, parables, gospels, heroes and idols, gods and martyrs. To this day, they file past Lenin's tomb on the Red Square to view his embalmed corpse. And today, Christians are going bananas over the possibility that the Shroud of Turin might be the actual burial cloth of Jesus. Some same kind of morbid death fixation. Hitler's final orders were that his remains were never to be found. The greatest similarity between these two ideologies is that all their monumental dogma is based on fear, enforced by ignorance, and with falsehood as their objective. It has brought the world to where it is today. In man's quest for reason and order in the universe, and in his desire to elevate himself from the rest of the animals roaming the planet, he invented God to answer all these needs. Every form of human being did this in the beginning, each in his own way, but there the similarity ends. From that point sprang the actual doctrine, the code, etc., and each separate race on this planet gave its own peculiar stamp to society building and personal conduct. If we are to be original and authentic in what we believe, profess, and practice, then we should return to the philosophy of our northern European ancestors and hail Odin and his host of Norse gods. It might be a flight of fancy, but it would at least be natural, normal, and healthy for our people to live by the religion which arose from its own blood at the dawn of time. But through various quirks of fate, through the machinations of schemers and manipulators, the white race got stuck with a noxious and repulsive religion cooked up in the twisted brains of a handful of Semites in the Middle East known as the Essenes, E-S-S-E-N-E-S. Over the centuries and through a dozen or more schisms, it is today known as Christianity. It is alien to our blood, to our natural instincts. It is false and deadly, and its organized body of work in the world today is dedicated to the destruction of the white race. It must go. We agree that unless anything equal or better exists with which to replace something, it is best to leave that something alone. We feel it would be a mistake, a retreat to return to the dim, distant past for an answer, though I agree we must rediscover our ancient heritage as there is much to be learned from it. Another reason for not seeking an alternative religion in the classic sense is because it is utterly foolish to postulate anything one cannot see, touch, and examine. Just as the Aryan race is the highest order of being yet produced on this planet by nature, so too is National Socialism the highest, most sophisticated, and advanced creed yet formulated by the white man for his own betterment. Nothing more than what today exists, or nothing more than that today exists, nothing more is required. It represents all of our needs. The message of these siege segments is not a negative one. It is, however, an important one. We cannot afford any longer the stupid mistake of mixing and confusing our goals and priorities, like so many right-wing types have done in the past. Quote, "For God, race, and nation is an example. You're mixing different things, pulling in different directions, even opposing directions. We cannot allow any foreign, alien moral code or dogma to cramp our revolutionary style. And when the big cleanup begins, no criminal will enjoy any hands-off privilege just because he may be a master of hocus-pocus or mumbo-jumbo. Our march toward revolution will not be blocked by any rules of the establishment, and our revolutionary new order will be absolutely free of any trace whatsoever of the old." And that on religion was Volume 10, Number 7, July 1981. And that will conclude this first section of Chapter 7. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again with the rest of Chapter 7 real soon.